Ja?
Hallå? Pizzeria Grandiosa? Jag vill ha en Grandiosa capriciosa och en pepperoni.
Haha, något mer?
En kaffefilter.
Ja, okej, ses samma.
Grandiosa, hela Sveriges hempizza. Den med mycket på.
Välkommen till Unionen.
Hej, jo jag ska ha lönesamtal och undrar om potten. Ja, om jag kan räkna med övertidsersättning, för det är så stressigt på kontoret, jag jobbar hemma på kvällarna, så kan jag då be om större skärm från chefen, för annars kanske jag säger upp mig själv. Och hur lång uppsägningstid har jag då?
Okej, vi börjar med lön.
Jobbigt på jobbet. Som medlem i Unionen kan du alltid prata med våra rådgivare.
Psst, känner du igen en riktigt smart deal när du hör den? 4 säckar plantjord för 100 kronor. Byggmax. Var smart. Handla billigt.
Han gick från relativt anonym professor vid universitetet i Toronto till att bli en världskändis. Jordan B. Peterson nådde snabbt kultstatus i vissa kretsar och blev lika hatad i andra efter sin offentliga protest mot lagförslaget C-16, vars syfte bland annat var att säkerställa att sexuella minoriteter skulle bli tilltalade på ett sätt som inte kränkte dem.
I can envision a student or a colleague insisting that I call them using gender neutral pronouns. I'm not doing that. I don't recognize another person's right to determine what pronouns I use to address them. I won't do it.
Jordan B. Peterson tycktes genom att tydligt kritisera politisk korrekthet och identitetspolitik säga det många ville höra. I boken 12 livsregler, ett motgift mot kaos, satte han ord på hur vilsna unga män genom att ta ansvar för sig själva och sina liv skulle kunna bli bättre partners och bättre fäder. Så hösten 2019 försvann han plötsligt från rampljuset. Den YouTube-kanal som följs av 3,5 miljoner tystnade, och i medierna var han inte synlig längre. Det visade sig så småningom att han drabbats av psykisk ohälsa och svåra komplikationer efter att ha försökt sluta med den ångestdämpande medicin han tagit under flera år. Något han berättade utförligt om i en intervju med dottern Mikaela.
What happened? Well, you know, an accident is when 3 or 4 or 5 unlikely things happen at the same time. And I would say that's what happened to me.
Professor Jordan B. Peterson, most welcome back to the Kvartal podcast Fredagsintervjun.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
You've now released a new book called Beyond Order, 12 More Rules for Life. Why weren't the original 12 Rules for Life enough?
Well, everybody knows you can't have too many rules.
Yeah.
Well, look, the original list was, which I posted on a website called Quora, which is a question and answer website. It had 42 rules, and I picked 12 to begin with that I thought would group thematically and put them in the first book. And it was 12 rules for life and an antidote to chaos. And chaos is one of the, what would you say? It's an existential certainty that you will encounter chaos in your life, and that that can be renewing or destructive. And so the book was aimed at helping people conceptualize chaos and helping guide them through what might constitute a reasonable means of construing chaos and also of responding to it. But that chaos isn't the only existential threat. There are pathologies of order as well. And so the second book concentrates more on that. And so partly the reason the first 12 rules weren't enough is because I had more to say about the dynamics of chaos and order. And I do believe that that it's extraordinarily useful from a practical perspective to abstract at the highest level possible the fundamental existential threats and opportunities that confront you and everyone else. So uncertainty, unexplored territory, the unexpected, the accidental, the consequences of mortality and illness, that's all part of our susceptibility to chaos. And then authoritarianism and censorship and oppression and war, let's say, slavery, and even the necessary bending of our individuality, let's say, to the collective, that's another threat that faces everyone. And we need to understand that that's a universal threat and formulate an appropriate response to it.
Comparing the first set of rules with these rules, the ones in the last book were more like stand up with their shoulders straight and pursue what's meaningful, not what's expedient, while the new ones have more of a gentle tone of voice. Do not hide unwanted things in the fog and do not do what you hate. Is that me being a bit oversensitive, or do I have a point there?
No, I think that's true. And I think part of that likely is that the second book, and perhaps also its author, are somewhat more sensitive to the vital role that interpersonal relationships play in people's lives. And I suppose that was highlighted for me, at least in part, because while I was writing this book, my family went through a series of health catastrophes, and we had support offered to us from friends and family and from the general public that was extraordinarily surprising in some sense in its intensity and depth and continuity and value. And so that's, I think, shaped me to some degree and the book as well. So I think there's less humor in the book because I wasn't in the mood to have my sense of humor at its peak. But I think it is, in some sense, gentler than the first one.
I've heard you say that a few times, that you were surprised of the degree of sympathetic people, not only the closest to you, but also people that might not agree with you upon those things you've been discussing publicly. You didn't get much hate or people saying, oh, wow, now you see your rules don't apply to you and so on.
Well, it's so hard to know what to make of that. I mean, there's a small minority of people who have been seriously dead set against me, so to speak, right from the beginning. And they view me as the embodiment of everything they deem rigid and malevolent. And it's very hard for me to tell what proportion, let's say, of the population that is. My sense is that it's a very, very tiny proportion, just as the proportion of radicals, and it's drawn mostly from the left-wing radical end of the political spectrum, let's say, and that's, by any reasonable definition of left-wing radical, that's only 3-5% of the population. And I think that's probably a reasonable estimate for the commonality of enmity towards me. And so that leaves a lot of people left over to be supportive. And I don't think that's blindness on my part. The books have sold extremely well and in very high volumes. And then I also have evidence from the YouTube channels and podcasts saying the YouTube comments, and there's hundreds of thousands of them, are positive at a ratio of about 25-1. And the like to dislike ratios is about 50-1, generally speaking. So there were people who were celebrating my potential demise and my collapse and all of that. But I certainly don't experience that when I'm out in public. All the interactions I have with people in the public domain when I'm walking around have been positive, with the exception of 2 in 5 years. And that would be thousands and thousands of encounters.
Last time I had the pleasure of talking to you was when you visited Sweden in the fall of 2018. And since then, as you mentioned, a lot has happened in your life. How would you summarize these 2.5 years that's passed since then?
Well, 2018 was extraordinarily exciting, and mostly in a positive direction. I was traveling with my wife all over the world, and I was engaged in a very intense tour that consisted of 90-minute lectures and a question period after that. And that was incredibly positive and exciting. There were the odd protests, but overall it was nothing but positive, and there were no negative incidents at the lectures or during the tour. But then in 2019, well, it started out, I spent a month in Switzerland with my daughter, and she had to have an ankle replacement redone because it had malfunctioned. And then my wife had been diagnosed with what we thought was a highly curable cancer later in 2019. And so then she went in for surgery, and that just spiraled downhill with incredible rapidity. And she was in a life or death situation daily for months and months on end, partly because the cancer had been misdiagnosed. It was much more aggressive than had originally been assumed. And what she was diagnosed with, I don't know if there's anyone who's lived through it except her. It's very rare, the cancer she had, but it's extraordinarily deadly. And the one-year mortality rate is 100%. And we found that out suddenly in what we thought would be a relatively routine post-surgical checkup. And then she suffered from terrible surgical complications because the second surgery, she had two surgeries for her cancer, and the second one was quite radical and damaged her lymphatic system. And then that didn't heal. So she was on the edge of death for months and months on end. And there was all sorts of social pressure continuing during that time as well on our whole family. And then I got sick after that. So the last 2 years have been 2019 and 2020 were absolutely dreadful.
But your wife did survive this against all odds, right?
Yes, and it's been 2 years since the original diagnosis. And she's doing well. I mean, she's healthy. She has some post-surgical complications still, but they're relatively minor, all things considered. And her perspective is very positive, and her quality of life is very high. And she's still shell-shocked that she's alive, and very grateful about that and about all the support that we received and all of that. So that's unbelievably positive. I seem to be recovering. I mean, a lot of things happened to me. It's not been easy to sort out what was at the root of my health problems. But this month I was diagnosed with severe central sleep apnea.
Oh.
So I wasn't sleeping. I was waking up 25 times an hour.
And you didn't know about that?
No, well, I'm thin and I don't snore. And so there was really no reason to assume that a sleep problem of that sort might be the problem. Typically, what would happen is that I would feel absolutely dreadful in the morning to a degree that's virtually impossible to communicate. And then I would improve throughout the day. And by the time 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. rolled around, I was relatively functional and normal. But then I'd sleep and, I'd be placed back in a pit of hell in the morning. And that was continual and very demoralizing.
Wow, that sounds like me. I think I should check that up, actually.
Well, it's not uncommon for people to feel worse in the morning, especially if they have a depressive temperament. And I have suffered from clinical depression. It's very pervasive in my family history. And so I also thought that was probably contributing to it. So I've been using a breathing machine for the last month, and I've gone from 5% functionality, I would say, to about 60% functionality, which is a lot better.
So this is really good news for you then, because just to take the listeners back to what happened, as I understand it, you started using benzodiazepines in early 2017?
Yes.
And you went through the challenging things that you mentioned before with your wife's illness and your daughter's surgery?
Yes. Well, what happened was that I got really ill in 2016, right at the end of 2016. And it isn't obvious what happened, although my life was tremendously stressful at that point because my clinical practice was threatened and my university job was threatened, and the Canadian tax authorities were after me for a mistake they made and admitted to 3 months later. And while there were a variety of other things happening as well. And so, plus I was becoming notorious in the press internationally, and it was very surreal and strange. And I got very ill, and I couldn't sleep for weeks. And I had a variety of symptoms that I couldn't understand. I couldn't stand up without fainting. I was freezing, and I was on vacation at that point. And when I came home, I went to my doctor and I told him I hadn't been able to sleep. And he gave me a sleeping medication and a benzodiazepine. And I only took the benzodiazepine, and I was able to sleep, and I continued taking them. My life was still extraordinarily stressful. It took me a long time to recover from whatever hit me in December. And I never really gave it a second thought, which was a mistake, obviously, but for most people, a moderate dose of benzodiazepine doesn't necessarily pose a tremendous threat, although the FDA has updated its guidelines late last year to indicate that they should not be taken for more than 2 weeks.
And you took them for a lot longer than that.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, I took them regularly for 3 years. But it was a dose that really had virtually no detectable impact on me. I mean, my decision was, well, I took these, I felt better. My life was still very chaotic and disturbed. I thought, well, this is working. I'm just going to leave well enough alone and not mess around because it's working. And I had stopped taking antidepressants, which I had been taking previously. And so I thought, well, this seems to be stabilizing me. I'm not going to tempt fate by modifying something that's working. Well, then when my wife was re-diagnosed, diagnosed the second time, I noted during the few months previous that my anxiety levels were starting to climb again. So I took a bit more of the benzodiazepine in conversation with my physician. But that didn't work well. And why that is, I don't know, but it seemed to make me worse rather than better. And then that started a whole cascade of events. And I was dependent on the benzodiazepines, and it was very, very difficult to stop taking them. And a minority of people do experience extremely severe withdrawal symptoms that can last for years. There's communities of benzodiazepine dependency forums, let's say, composed of people who've having this sort of reaction, and their experiences are absolutely horrific.
Right. So when you try to get off them, that's when the real big problems started. What happened?
Well, the most striking effect was that I couldn't stop moving.
That's what's called akathisia, right?
Akathisia, yes, yes. And it's so horrible that it's indescribable.
That's anxiety on its highest level.
It's a combination of anxiety and pain, but it's more than that. It's like being prodded by a cattle prod or by a dozen cattle prods simultaneously. You know, if you get a sensation now and then, like an itch that develops somewhere, and then you're compelled to move your hand to that part of your body. Well, if you magnified that by a factor of 100 and made it happen every 2 or 3 seconds everywhere at once, then that's what akathisia is like, except it's much worse than that. It's indescribably awful. And so I couldn't sit down for more than a year. I couldn't rest at all, ever.
Could you sleep?
Luckily, well, I still had this diurnal characteristic, which was it was much, much, much worse in the morning and then would gradually improve throughout the day. Then by the time nighttime came, I could sleep. And thank God for that. That was the one saving grace. And I've spoken with akathisia sufferers who have it all the time, including at night. And I wouldn't have been able to live through that, I don't think. I knew at least during the day that in all likelihood I would get a break at night. So I was living to go to sleep, essentially. I was praying constantly that the day would end so that I could go to sleep.
It's truly amazing to realize when I've watched the interview your daughter made with you in Serbia, when you just recovered or started to recover, what a fight she and her husband put up to make you survive. I hope my kids would do that for me, but that's almost more than you could expect from anyone.
It was many people in my life went above and beyond the call of duty. And I was left aghast, I would say amazed at their altruistic care, and certainly wasn't convinced that I would have been able to do the same for someone else. And that was with many people, many of my friends, many family members. And thank God we had that support. And certainly my daughter and my son-in-law went far above and beyond. It was complicated because they were working for me at the same time. So, you know, we also were set up financially so that that was possible. Thank God for that. And had those resources at hand, and that helped, obviously.
Yeah, and you could seek hospitals all around the world, more or less, Russia and Serbia, and that's, of course, not possible.
Well, Northeast US, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And so can they relax now a little bit more, at least your daughter?
Well, my daughter is in the Middle East right now, and so is my son-in-law, and and they've been there a couple of weeks, and I told her explicitly 2 weeks ago to stop worrying about me, that she could she didn't have to worry about me at the moment, that things look much better. And this diagnosis of, sleep disorder has made a tremendous difference to me. So now I can relax, and I'm still shocked at that. Every time I sit down and nothing terrible happens, it's a miracle. You certainly learn to appreciate things you take for granted when things you don't even know you could lose are taken away from you. I mean, no one ever is afraid that they won't be able to sit down. But believe me, I fantasized, an image came to mind constantly of sitting in front of a fire in the evening and just relaxing, and because that was absolutely impossible. And akathisia is so awful that there's no words can begin to describe it. It's unpleasant enough so that people who suffer from it, even for hours, become suicidal.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you, if you don't mind, what kept you alive? Because it sounds like a life-threatening torture, actually.
Responsibility and love. And that's all, because that's all. That's all. I mean, partly, that's what it was. Is, I suppose, with some hope, although not so much that, because after that had been going on for months, shading into years, hope became an ambivalent ally, you know, because dashed hope is pretty catastrophic. So, but I have a responsibility, as we all do, to the people around us, to the people we love. And also, you know, I mean, I have people for whom my work has been useful and have rebuilt their life or put their life on a firmer foundation because of it. And yeah, I have a responsibility to those people, which I take very seriously. You know, this is no game for me, what I'm doing. And, you know, I get letters from people all the time, and people stop me on the street all the time and tell me that reading what I've written has been extremely useful to them, and that they've started to put their life on a firm foundation. And, you know, they're relying on, I don't want to invalidate what I've done that's been useful and good. So
there's something you said in the interview with your daughter that really got to me. Let's listen to a short clip.
What's the old saying? Physician, heal thyself, right? I wrote a self-help book. I'm a psychologist. It's like, well, why the hell didn't I see this coming? And why wasn't I more cautious? And I think those are reasonable questions.
Why should people take advice?
Well, and then that's the next question, is why should people take anything I say seriously?
Yeah, what's your answer to your own question now, today?
Well, I would say that's up to the people who are reading and listening to decide. And I would hope that my words, to the degree that they're mine, stand on their own. In large part, I'm functioning as a public clinical psychologist. And the ideas that I've put forward in my books are original in some sense, but also derivative in many important senses. And I've tried to encapsulate and integrate clinical theories that have been developed by many great clinical psychologists and psychiatrists, and to put them forward in a manner that's publicly consumable and applicable. And so the vagaries of my life are not particularly relevant with regard to the utility of those ideas. But I would also say that more on that is that, well, if you're not going to communicate with anyone who is vulnerable, then you might as well just stop communicating, because we all fall short of immortality. We all become sick. We all die. And not only that, we're all flawed. And so me as much as anyone else, or perhaps more for that matter, well, you have to separate the wheat from the chaff. And the people that are not pleased with my existence, let's say, would claim that it's all chaff, but well, you know, they haven't generally read anything I've written or listened to anything I said. They just assume on the basis of their a priori presumptions and go from there.
You reflected in this interview that I'm referring to with your daughter, you reflected around the illness of your wife compared to your illness, saying that more or less no one would ever say that something she did inflicted her illness. But in my case, maybe people would say, why didn't he do that? And why didn't he see it coming? He's supposed to be the expert. What's your reflections on that?
Well, that tortured me to death the whole time I was ill. I mean, one of the dreadful things about being ill with something that isn't clearly diagnosable is that you have no idea what you may have contributed or are continuing to contribute to its initial existence and its persistence. And so without a definitive diagnosis, because it was a multi-symptomatic illness, I was constantly beset by moral doubts. And I looked to see if I had been doing anything wrong, which I'm still doing diligently and doing whatever I can to rectify that as fast as I possibly can in every direction possible. And that's all I can do. What happened to me is still not completely clear to me. Although I mentioned I have been diagnosed with a central nervous system sleep disorder, and now that's treated and I'm much better. So clearly that was a major contributor. Hopefully it was the primary contributor, in which case it wasn't a consequence of something I did or failed to do, except insofar as I might have inadvertently complicated the problem.
Well, there were things, of course, you couldn't really control. I mean, going from a half-anonymous professor in Canada to a world celebrity, that would be a challenge for anyone, I guess.
Yeah, well, you could make the case there that I put my own neck in the noose and continued to tighten it even when that might have been ill-advised. And I mean, I think I've asked myself seriously any question that anyone who hated me would be happy to ask me. And I've tried to struggle through all of them. I also know from my clinical practice that it's not useful to burden yourself with moral guilt that's not appropriate. And so I'm trying to separate out the reasonable accusations that would lead to useful behavioral changes from those that are merely a consequence of guilt and shame, all of that. And, you know, I have people around me constantly that I can talk to honestly and who are helping me sort this out and who continue to do that. And thank God for that. And it's not like I don't pay attention to the people who are criticizing me. I pay very careful attention and try to see if they're accusations have merit, and insofar as they do, I try to rectify that behavior.
So, ending this part of the interview, I want to ask you, one, do you feel hope again? Two, how do you feel today?
Well, I'm running at about 60% of my capacity now instead of about 5%, and so that's way better. I mean, my life has gone from truly unbearable to difficult, and difficult I can manage. I'm still in a lot of pain. I have a lot of neurological damage by all appearances. So my hands and my feet are constantly on fire. That's how they feel. Well, fire might be too dramatic. They feel like they're immersed in water that's way too hot. And that's not pleasant, but it's compared to what I was going through, it's virtually nothing. And I'm still fatigued to a great degree.
What about hope?
Well, even when I didn't have hope, I wished I had hope. I mean, one of the perverse things about my illness was that I felt like Tantalus. There's this Greek myth. This is where the word tantalized comes from. So Tantalus was punished by the gods. He was sentenced to spend eternity on the banks of a beautiful crystalline river, surrounded by trees that bore the most magnificent ripe fruit and delicious ripe fruit. But when he walked towards the river, it would recede away from his outstretched hand, and the boughs of the branches would lift when he tried to eat. And so everything that could possibly be imagined was laid out in front of him, but he couldn't indulge in any of it. And I've been in that perverse position because I have so many opportunities to pursue in my life that it's surreal, I would say. Yet I was so ill that pursuing any of them seemed extremely impossible. And so it was very frustrating. Now you could say, well, would you rather have been in a position where you had no opportunities? And the answer to that obviously is, well, that no. But that doesn't mean there wasn't a kind of perverse torture in it. And there certainly was. Well, now that I've regained my health to a substantive degree, I am starting to be able to move in the direction of those opportunities. And so I'm thrilled about that. I'm still trying to put myself back together completely, trying to figure out even who I am at the moment. I mean, I've been on leave from my university position for 4 years now, and I'm not practicing as a clinical psychologist, and that's been 4 years as well. I'm not doing the latter because it's not appropriate to work as a clinician if you can't devote all your attention to your clients. And if your life becomes too complicated so that you're forced or even inclined to concentrate on your own affairs, especially during a clinical session, say, if those thoughts start entering the theater of your mind, then you're too overwhelmed to be of use and you're likely to make a mistake. And you can make a very bad mistake as a clinician. So I stopped doing that as soon as I felt that I couldn't concentrate properly. And then I went on tour, and then there's been this period of illness. And so now I'm not only trying to recover my health, but I'm essentially facing retirement in some sense. Should I go back to the university? And if not, what should I do? And those are complicated problems. Everyone faces them when they make a major transition in their life, but this coincides with a major illness for me and also the major illness of my wife. And so our relationship also has to be restructured in a dramatic way, because both of us are quite different than we were before all of this happened. And neither of us really know who, we don't know ourselves and we don't know the other person anymore. But having said all that, well, I'm trying to sort through all that, and it seems to be working. And so I hope that continues. And I have so many opportunities. I mean, I'm in this terribly fortunate position. I'm working on my YouTube channel and as a podcast interviewer, and I can basically reach out to virtually anyone in the world, assuming they're not in that small camp of people who regard themselves as my ideological enemies. And they'll, in all likelihood, agree to talk to me. And so that's, I don't know exactly what to do with that.
Vi tillhandahåller högkvalitativa texter och poddar som är helt kostnadsfria för alla att ta del av. Vi har ingen reklam, inga prenumerationsavgifter och inga betalväggar. Och så vill vi gärna fortsätta ha det. Skälet till att det fungerar är att många av er som läser och lyssnar på Kvartal också emellanåt ger oss ett frivilligt bidrag. Vi tackar er för det. Ni gör en stor insats för mediemångfald och samhällsinformation. Har du ännu inte blivit en av Kvartals frivilliga bidragsgivare men vill bli det? Alla bidrag, stora som små, spelar stor roll för oss. Information om hur du då går tillväga hittar du på kvartal.se/gava. kvartal.se/gava. I'm going to change the direction of this conversation a little bit.
Sure.
Like I said in my introduction, you went from a celebrity at your university, to a celebrity in the whole world. How have you reflected on how that might have affected you and not the least your self-image before all this that we discussed now happened?
Well, it's very hard to conceptualize. I don't know how to conceptualize it so exactly. I mean, there's a variety of, let's say, philosophical problems that arise. And I would also say, from a clinical perspective, whenever anyone is forced to reevaluate their sense of self at a fundamental level, that's a traumatic problem, because your sense of self is something at the core of all of your assumptions. And so when that shifts and moves, then everything shifts and moves, and everything is too much.
Even if it shifts for a good reason.
Yes.
I mean, this was the result of your success.
Yes. Success. Well, let's say success and notoriety in some weirdly intermingled manner. Mm. And, you know, my sense to begin with was that I would be a flash in the pan, essentially, that the focus of interest in me would shift and then move. And that's the most likely prediction. And I certainly expected that to happen, but it has definitely not happened. And so now I've been trying to figure out, to think through why that hasn't happened and what that signifies. And that's extremely complicated. Like, it's not obvious. Now I'm playing with the idea that, well, first of all, I'm trying to see myself from outside, which is hard because I'm inside my bubble, so to speak. And so I have biased information. And so I can't conceptualize my position in the broader world. Say, I know that I'm very well known everywhere. I know that because of the sheer volume of views that my lectures get online, let's say, but also because whenever I travel, wherever I go, people always stop me. And it doesn't matter where I am in the world or in an airport or on the street or so. That's quite clear. And then I'm trying to figure out, well, who does that make me comparable to exactly? What sort of person am I exactly? Am I like Jonathan Haidt, the New York University professor who runs the Heterodox Academy, or Steven Pinker, another public intellectual, Michael Shermer, someone like that, or perhaps Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins. I'm not comparing myself directly with any of those men, understand, but I'm trying to get a handle on what it is that I am, let's say. Well, I do have one foot in the scientific and rational world, but I think one of the things that makes me different is that I also have one foot in the mythological and religious world. And that makes me unlike the men that I just listed. By and large, they're mostly Enlightenment rationalists and empiricists, scientists, and more power to them as far as I'm concerned. I was a practicing scientist for decades. But there's this additional element that characterizes my thinking. And I think the reason that I've become, as Nellie Balls called me in the New York Times, defender of the patriarchy, you know, both to my viewers and readers and also to my detractors, is that I do mount a defense for what I regard as the valuable elements of our culture, both on the religious and mythological side and on the scientific and rational side. And so if the radicals who want to tear everything down are looking for an emblem of what they're opposed to, I sort of fit the bill. And perhaps rightly so. I am a product. I mean, I'm a product of the modern Western education system and a standard bearer for it, for better or worse.
But unlike the persons you referred to, you became, maybe against your will actually, a political figure in many ways. I know that you've struggled with that. Why do you think that happened?
Well, it was because it was complicated. Again, the proximal cause was that I commented on what you could argue was a political issue, which was the formulation of a particular bill in Canada that mandated a particular kind of speech. And so I regarded it as a compelled speech, a piece of legislation mandating compelled speech. And it happened to focus on the rights and identity of individuals who were struggling with their gender identity. And that was more it wouldn't have had to be that issue. It wasn't an issue that I had any particular interest in specifically. It's not that I regard it as unimportant or trivial. It's just that it wasn't something that had occupied my thinking. But I looked into the legislation in some detail and realized that it was unprecedented. What it was doing was unprecedented. And for me, to begin with, it was a free speech issue. And the issue specifically was the issue of compelled speech. The government has drafted legislation that means you have to say this. And that's different from the government drafting legislation saying that you can't say this. So let's say anti-hate speech legislation, which I also have a substantial amount of trouble with and think that by and large does far more damage than good. But for me, the politicians, in the pursuit of what they liked to believe was a moral end, had jumped out of the political domain altogether into the philosophical or even religious domain by insisting on compelled speech. And my firm belief is you do not get to tell me what to say. I don't care what your reason is. Now, perhaps we you and I, as people of goodwill, could negotiate a solution to the problem of how we're going to communicate with one another, and that's fine. I do that with people all the time. But when it comes to compulsion, that's a whole different matter. And then I've realized more recently that there was more to it than that, although I had an intuition of that at the time, but I hadn't thought through the issue completely. So it was more of an intuition, something that was bothering me.
To put it really simple, if I was to identify myself as a woman, let's say, and I want you, Jordan, to call me her, and that's something you fought for your right to refuse to do that. Is that correct?
Hej, Synoptik här. Visste du att solens UV-strålar kan vara skadliga och åldra dina ögon i förtid? Kom in till oss så hjälper vi dig att hitta rätt solglasögon som skyddar dina ögon. Välkommen till Synoptik.
Upptäck hyllade Xpeng G9 och P7 hos Bilia. Våra produktspecialister hjälper dig att hitta rätt modell för just dig. Boka din provkörning på bilia.se/xpeng redan idag. Välkommen till Bilia, din specialist på Xpeng.
CSRD. Ännu en förkortning som väcker känslor hos företagare. Men lugn, våra rådgivare här på PwC har koll på det som din verksamhet berörs av. Från hållbarhetslösningar och nya regelverk till affärsutveckling och ansvarsfulla AI-strategier. Välkommen till PwC.
Only to refuse the compulsion. See, what I've done, and I've watched myself, because you might ask, well, what is your view on that situation, on that circumstance? What's happened when I've been placed in those circumstances is that I use the nomenclature that the person chooses. I know I've had discussions with directly with people who have a transgender identity, and then indirectly as panel members with people who have switched genders. And my automatic response, assuming that I'm not being compelled, is to do what seems socially appropriate in the situation.
So refer to them with their preferred gender identity.
Yes. So I was on a panel in Great Britain, for example. We weren't discussing transgender issues per se, but one of the panelists, and a very reasonable person, is by all accounts, was a former military officer, male, who had transitioned to female. And it was obviously the most straightforward and appropriate thing to do was to just go along with that presentation. But it's the compulsion. That's the issue. It's the use of force.
I see what you mean. It's on another level, but it could apply to other issues as well.
Well, it certainly will. I mean, it was also the case that the American Supreme Court mandated back in the 1940s explicitly forbade compelled speech. So except there are some exceptions made for commercial speech. So you can compel a tobacco company to put a warning on their cigarettes, for example.
That's compelled speech, right. But normally when we try to understand these expressions of authoritarianism, because it is in a way, we tend to focus on collective movements where people cease to act as individuals and cease to think for themselves. Now, in the landscape we're living in the Western world, the views that are dominating are the individualistic values. People tend to be less religious and so on. Is there a paradox that this tendency towards authoritarianism exists at the same time as we have these individualistic values?
I think it's inevitable that when you push anything too far in one direction, there's a counter movement in the other. So, I mean, one of the things you do see, for example, on the radical left end of the distribution is the insistence that each individual can choose their identity, especially on the gender spectrum, as they see fit, but that the most important thing about all individuals is their group identity. It's like, well, you actually can't hold both of those viewpoints simultaneously, which is also partly, it's the illogicality that of the presumptions, the set of presumptions underlying these sorts of movements that made me object to begin with, and the very confused sense of identity that's an implicit part of the legislation. Whatever your identity is, it's certainly not reducible to your felt sense of sexual identity. And it's by no means clear whatsoever that whatever your identity is something that you have the right to impose on other people. No one does that except for antisocial two-year-olds. And I mean that technically. We all negotiate our identities with other people, or we use force. So it's the force that I'm objecting to.
Another collective movement that's been very strong historically is, of course, the one of religion, and that's declining in the Western world. What do you think has replaced religion, that some things that tells right from wrong and good from bad in our modern Western society?
Unexamined ideology masquerading as rationality. You remove Catholicism, say, with its ritual and mystery, and within that its body of thought, and you replace it with something that's far more, what would you call it, trivial, I would say, lifeless and also dangerous.
How so dangerous?
Well, there's nothing more dangerous than radical Marxism, let's say, except possibly radical Nazism. I mean, they're the same thing in some fundamental sense. They're obviously terribly dangerous.
Yeah, obviously. But you see those tendencies in our modern society where the individualistic dominance turns to its opposite in a way, and a new authoritarianism is coming up.
Well, I have taken very seriously the prognostication of Nietzsche that there would be terrible consequences because of the death of God. And Nietzsche believed that, well, that we would oscillate between nihilism and authoritarianism, essentially, as a consequence of the demolition of our religious beliefs. And I believe that's exactly right. And I think the bulk of the evidence supports that viewpoint. And then the question is, well, you know, for the rationalist, materialist, atheist types, that religious tradition was nothing but superstition to be superseded. But that's just not the case. It wasn't nothing but superstition. It wasn't quasi-empirical science masquerading as knowledge. It was an attempt to identify the contours of the ethical landscape, and in the process to satisfy the religious instinct. And we have a religious instinct. If you're a credible neuroscientist and you know the literature on emotion and motivation, the existence of the religious instinct is incontrovertible. It's there. Well, why? And what's it pointing to? And what does that mean? And I think part of the reason that people have focused their interest on what I'm doing is that I'm trying to answer that question in a very serious way, in the most serious possible way.
Let me give you one example of this to be a little bit more concrete. We have world celebrity and climate activist Greta Thunberg here in Sweden. And a representative of the Swedish church actually tweeted the following: announcement, Jesus of Nazareth has now appointed one of his successors, namely Greta Thunberg.
Right, right. Good point.
Maybe that summarizes your talking about that we are religious creatures. We have religious instincts. Is this another way, this climate activism, right or wrong, is that another way of manifesting that religious instinct, you think?
Yes, yes. It's a variant of worship of the mother. It's a variant of that. And there are all sorts of things that strike us as sacred, deeply sacred, whether we want them to strike us that way or not. And one is the benevolence of nature, let's say. And that, from my investigations, that to me is the domain of feminine symbolism primarily. And so it's Mother Earth worship. And there's something to it, obviously. We have to maintain the environment in which we exist. We have to maintain and tend it. And it's a fundamental moral obligation. And if we fail at that, we die. And we have died many times in the past as a consequence of failing to do that. But that doesn't mean that instinct towards preservation, let's say, is a sufficient moral guide in its raw form, unstructured by tradition, and put forth with the force of a final moral argument. The planet would be better off if there were no people on it.
Definitely. But how do you distinguish these matters or these issues that have this religious, more or less, dimensions from other disputes, like things where we really can disagree without being declared as bad people? If I say climate change is not happening, someone would call me ungodly, more or less.
Oh, I think it's partly because of their comprehensiveness, right? I mean, climate, for people who are terrified by the potential of environmental destruction, it's apocalyptic. It has to be the most important issue because everything else by definition depends on it. Now, and my attitude towards that is that it's much better to decompose those problems into their constituent elements. And that's the appropriate technical approach, which is why I'm an admirer of Bjørn Lomborg, who I think has done a better job of that than anyone on the planet. He's got a method for doing it. And, you know, Lomborg takes climate change quite seriously, and he lays out a practical and pragmatic way of dealing with it to the degree that it can be dealt with, while simultaneously noting that many other things are also important.
Yeah, and he doesn't instruct us to panic, which Greta Thunberg actually does.
Well, there's the danger of not reacting, and there's the danger of overreacting. And Lomborg doesn't want people to spend $2 trillion in an ill-advised policy that will produce no detectable outcome whatsoever, when there are other things that we could be doing, like increasing the nutritional support for young children in developing countries, which would have an immediate, positive, measurable impact that would be of definite benefit to millions of people. And if you're going to take these things seriously, you have to take them seriously. And the religious element there that we've been discussing, it deals in generalities of the sort that aren't helpful. And it's worse than that, because holding that viewpoint also allows you to locate evil somewhere convenient, and usually somewhere outside of you. And so that's also, and that's extraordinarily dangerous, because the appropriate thing to do with external evil is to eradicate it. We've seen where that goes. That's why I insist that people deal with the evil in their own psyches, that's the place to start. And to be very, very wary of casual demonization of other people.
I would like to let the last part of this interview be about Sweden, since this is a podcast mainly aimed for a Swedish audience after all. And I think Sweden in many senses is a very strong example of what we just discussed. But before we go into that, you have a rather large fan base here in Sweden. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think the reason for that is that people find my ideas interesting intellectually, let's say, but also practically useful. And that's not accidental, because I was trained as a behavioral psychologist. And what you do as a behavioral psychologist is take abstractions and make them concrete. It's like, okay, well, you want your life to be better. Okay, what do you mean by better exactly? And then what steps can you concretely take that are implementable day to day that will move you in that direction? And how do you monitor and improve that? And so that framework of decomposition and structuring underlies everything I write about. And so people find that practically useful, and they apply some of these ideas, and then their lives get better. And so that makes them extremely excited and happy. And so then they do it some more. And then they come up to me on the street and they're almost dancing because they're so bloody happy that they've fixed things up and they can hardly believe it.
I have another theory, or at least a complementary theory. Your views, at least the views that you've been famous for, there's probably no country in the world where that contradicts as much to those ideas as Sweden does. Do you think that could be one part of your popularity, and also that you're a bit infamous in Sweden?
Well, I think the Swedes can experiment with the least authoritarian structures because their society is so structured. Right. I mean, your country, which is relatively small and relatively homogenous, and in terms of its ethnic makeup.
Well, not anymore, actually.
Well, that's changing with some rapidity, but compared to many places, it's still essentially the case. And your society is extremely peaceful, and all the tradition is implicit. So there's not much need for authoritarian force. And so Swedes can experiment with the most benevolent of social policies because so much of the structure is already built into the society. But that's simply not the case in many, many countries. So,
but that's really interesting because I think 10, 20 years ago, that was definitely true. But many Swedes experience a difference in that sense that it isn't that safe anymore. We have big problems with gang violence, people shooting each other on the streets. And that's rather new to Sweden in the way we have it now. And we have big, big problems with integration of new immigrants.
Right.
So that has sparked a feeling of insecurity, I think. And maybe also that people, some people at least, want to see more of, if not authoritarianism, at least authority. What's your reflections on that? Because I think things are happening here that we're not used to.
Well, I would say they may be happening there in a manner that you're not used to, but they're still not happening there to the degree that they're happening in most places in the world. And I'm not trying to make light of Sweden's problems, don't get me wrong. Although I do think it's difficult to get a really firm grip on how much things have deteriorated with regards to, say, felt personal safety over the last 15 years. It's very, very difficult to get data on that that's reliable. If things are pushed to the point where some of these implicit traditions are violated, well, then chaos is going to start to manifest itself. So you guys don't know, for example, at what rate you can integrate people who aren't of your culture without that producing destabilization in ways that you don't want. I mean, no one knows that, right? We don't have a mathematics for that. And I suppose it depends to some degree on who it is that you're admitting and under what circumstances. But we don't want to ever forget to note that the reason that Sweden can experiment is because it was and is in many regards so unbelievably stable and law-abiding. So that it's just built into everyone to a degree it's so built in that it's invisible. And it's the hallmark of a thoroughly civilized society. That doesn't mean it should be taken for granted.
No, and what I feel in Sweden is that up till recently, people were feeling the way you describe, that this system is so robust, nothing can change it. And couple of last 5 years maybe or so, people are not as convinced about that anymore. And I hear more and more that people want authority in a way that we're not used to, you know, tougher on crime, tougher in school, all that. And I just wonder where that can lead us.
Right. Well, that's a non-differentiated reaction to the emergence of chaos. Well, what do you want as an antidote to chaos? More order. It's like, well, wait a second. What you need to do is, and this is very, very difficult. And I talk about it to some degree in chapter 6 of my book. I think it's chapter 6, which is abandon ideology. It's like, well, you want to take one of those problems. Like, well, maybe there's a rising rate of rape, for example, sexual assault. Well, is there exactly where, by exactly what measures and what's causing it? And then to focus in on exactly the cause and to address that carefully and experimentally to reduce it. Without doing that, and that's very hard. It's very hard to do that. It's hard conceptually because you have to decompose the problem. It's hard to come up with the definitions. It's hard to do the measurements accurately. It's hard to design the interventions. It's hard to test them, etc. But that's the right response rather than a knee-jerk reaction, which is, well, we need more order. It's like, well, yes, except that order has its pathologies as well, of course, and that's people automatically become afraid of that.
Yeah, right. But what you describe as the right way to go about this is probably quite the opposite towards what I feel is in the air right now.
Let me give you an example. Okay. So there was a recent report released in the UK about race relations. It was commissioned by Boris Johnson, and it was commissioned because, really, because of the claims that Britain was characterized by systemic racism. And that's an accusation that's leveled against the patriarchy everywhere in the West now. So the question is it true? So the people who mounted this committee, who looked like a credible bunch and who were made up by and large of minority members, for whatever that's worth, headed by a very respectable Black intellectual who has a credible ethical history. And their conclusion was, no, there is no systemic racism in Britain. If you compare the probability of success across ethnic groups, what you find is that the native-born whites are by no means doing the best. But there are groups where there are groups who are disproportionately unsuccessful. And those in specifically were Caribbean Blacks, but not African Blacks. Okay, so Black doesn't seem to be the issue. So it doesn't seem like a race issue, or if it is, it's not a simple race issue. It's not a simple matter of instantaneous prejudice. Well, more detailed analysis seemed to reveal that it was a consequence of destabilized families, that in the Caribbean Black community, the rate of single-parent families is over 70%. It's much lower in the African immigrant population, and that seems to be the determining factor. So the disproportionate disadvantage that some racial groups appears to have in England is actually a proxy for a destabilized family structure, assuming that's all correct. And there's a plenty of evidence suggesting that single parent families are not optimal, all things considered. So that's the kind of careful decomposition that's necessary. But, you know, and there's outrage about it because, well, obviously the committee was biased and so forth and so on. But it's still the kind of careful analysis that's the only alternative to a knee-jerk call for a renewed order. And we don't want that. It's too religious in some sense.
I'd like to spend the last couple of minutes on the issue where you may be most controversial in Sweden, and that's of course about gender and feminism and so on.
Oh yeah.
And why do you think this issue is so particularly flammable in Sweden?
Oh, it's because the people who are pushing for equality of outcome don't know what they're talking about. They're so ignorant about the relevant data that it's staggering, you know. So since I pointed out 5 years ago that, for example, as you make societies more egalitarian, as you have in Sweden, the certain differences between the sex magnify instead of shrinking, the data supporting that conclusion has just got stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. It's clearly happening. And so that's particularly relevant in terms of occupational choice, for example. So a disproportionate number of men who are interested in things more than people, which is a masculine characteristic, are much more likely to become engineers. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't women who are interested in things or that women can't be good engineers. It means, though, that if you allow people their free choice, sex differences linked to interest are going to produce variable outcomes. Well, that goes against the doctrine that human beings are completely malleable in any direction that social policy wishes to take them, which is the fervent dream of left-wing radicals, for example, and not infrequently right-wing radicals, for that matter, is simply not true, at least not in some circumstances. What it also indicates is that there are reasons for inequality of outcome. So let's say different numbers of women as engineers compared to men, or nurses compared for women compared to nurses for men. It's not a consequence of prejudice or the arbitrary oppression of the patriarchy, and actually attempts to modify the authority structure actually make those divergences grow. And that's crystal clear.
This particular issue was one of the themes when you were guest in the popular TV show Skavlan when you were here in Sweden and you met Swedish politician Annie Lööf. Your short conversation with her drew a lot of attention, and let's listen to a short clip of that.
Look, one of the things you want to ask yourself is that What is the purpose of setting up a society that offers maximal equality of opportunity? And one of the answers is that you maximize people's free choice. And if you maximize free choice, then you also maximize differences in choice between people. And so you can't have both of those.
But of course it will have differences in choice, of course, because we are human beings. But I can't see why it differs between me and Skavlan, for instance. But of course it differs in biological things, but not in choices, because I think more how we raise them, how we live, education, a sort of culture, attitudes form a human being, whether or not they are a girl or a boy when they grow up. Mm-hmm. And if I raise my daughter to become a leader, to be self-confident, to have a high education, for instance, I think she will have a good platform to become a civil engineer, to become a CEO of a company, or to become a nurse.
Well, that is what people who think that the differences between people who are primarily culturally constructed believe, but it's not what the evidence suggests.
Okay, we don't agree on that.
And there's a lot more evidence now than there was then. So,
okay, and the last thing she says is, I do not agree.
Yeah, well, if you listen to her answer,
yeah.
So the first thing you see is that the beginning of her answer is completely incoherent. She claims opposite things at the same time in a broken sort of way. And then she regains her footing because she wanders onto territory that she's familiar with. And then she spouts the platitudes that she's familiar with, which, and some of them are true. It's like, well, of course, culture determines such things. Culture in part determines such things as self-confidence and general competence. That's undeniable, but that's not the point. And it's a consequence of undifferentiated thinking. And the reality of the situation is that you can't have equality of opportunity that facilitates free choice and equality of outcome at the same time. And she didn't address that at all. You know, she just shifted the question into a form that made her right and me wrong, but it wasn't the same question.
I would still say that what she said was probably something that most Swedish people would agree on, like instinctively.
Yes, well, and instinctively, it's not a bad choice, because it is the case that culture, upbringing, and so forth have a very marked determinative effect on people's outcomes, but it's not the only factor. And sometimes it works in the opposite direction. So the details matter. That's the thing. Well, look at it this way. Like, let's say you're going to decide to become an engineer. Well, there's 100 things you could have decided to become, right? So why engineer? Well, because your interest strongly tilts you in that direction. Now, you might have enough competence to be an engineer, even mathematical competence, but that doesn't, you need that plus the interest. Well, the data show quite clearly that an approximately equivalent number of adolescent males and females fall into the sufficiently gifted category in mathematical ability so that a career choice in that direction would be a possibility. But the same data also revealed that men likely have a slight advantage in that direction, although women have a verbal advantage. But even more importantly, that the females who have the higher mathematical ability levels also tend to have higher verbal levels. And so they have a wider range of choices available to them, where the males are less likely to have both. And these details matter. And if you're going to have a sophisticated discussion about social policy, let's say, one that's appropriate to the year 2021, the details matter.
That seems to be like the motto of this whole interview. Details matter and decompose. That's interesting. The foreign minister, Margot Wallström, said about you, quote, I think he should crawl back under the rock he came from. And that's a statement about you from one of Sweden's most prominent and experienced politicians.
Well, first of all, she confuses who she thinks I am with who I am. She confuses what she thinks I said with what I actually said. And she's, to the degree that she did understand what I was saying, she's disturbed, as she should be. Because, look, it's disturbing to note that if you transform your society in an egalitarian direction, that certain intrinsic differences between men and women magnify. No one would vote for that to be the case. Everyone kind of hoped that if you did the social transformation, that some of these intrinsic tensions would disappear, but they didn't. And so we have to take that into account. And then maybe you also have to think, well, maybe that's okay. It's going to be complicated to sort out, but you know, maybe it's okay that people, that we're not uniformly distributed across all possible categories. And it's certainly the case that the data indicate, as far as I'm concerned, that if you really want equality of outcome, let's say between men and women, you're going to have to use force, because you're not going to get it any other way. And as soon as you start to use force to attain those ends, you're going to cause way more trouble than you're fixing.
A related issue. Since many years back, we have this discussion on toxic masculinity in Sweden and destructive masculine norms, but never, or almost never, any talk of toxic femininity and destructive feminine norms. I ran two searches on Swedish Google just before this interview. Toxic masculinity got me 18,500 hits, and toxic femininity only 565. How should that be understood?
Well, I just did an interview, which I'm going to release in the next month, with one of the world's leading authorities on the development of aggression. And I worked with him 30 years ago and have remained familiar with the literature. There is a toxic pattern of femininity, aggression, so a female aggression. Mm-hmm. Young males, children, adolescents, but let's start with children. Violent males, aggressive males, tend to use, they kick, hit, bite, and steal. And they start doing that at two. Females use reputation destruction. And there's a decent literature on female antisocial behavior. And that's the female pattern of antisocial behavior. It's innuendo, gossip, reputation destruction. And it scales on social media, whereas male aggression doesn't.
That would be a very controversial thing to say in Sweden, I think. Even mentioning those two words together, toxic and femininity, would be a...
Well, even the idea that the primary outlet for female aggression is reputation destruction is enough to make you instantly unpopular and have your reputation destroyed. But it doesn't matter, because I'm not saying this because I like it. It's all the same to me whether girls hit as much as boys or whether they do something else. But the data, the studies reveal that that's not the case. Now, the man I interviewed, for example, when he started his research, and he's been researching aggression for four decades, he was quite convinced that children learn aggression. But his research revealed, I think, incontrovertibly, that it's the control of aggression that's learned. Aggression is there right from the beginning. And the most aggressive of all people are two-year-olds. And almost all of them get less aggressive as they're socialized. So a lot of our folk assumptions are, especially when looking for the devil in the details, they mislead us. And why wouldn't they? I mean, if you look at the relationship between the earth and the sun, your folk intuitions tell you that you're standing on a flat disk and that the sun is rotating around the earth. That's what it looks like. But it's not true.
But what makes me curious is that this self-image that boys get from hearing this talk about toxic masculinity all the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And on the other hand, that girls never hear that there could be anything problematic with being a girl or girlish attitudes. What does that do to young boys growing up in an atmosphere like this, you think?
Oh, I think it's unbelievably corrosive. And I do think that this is part of the reason that people have found my work helpful. Look, if you fundamentally assume that Western culture is a tyrannical patriarchy, and maybe as a corollary that groups of men organize themselves according to the principle of power, then you more or less reflexively assume that any manifestation of ambitious striving or even competence on the part of any developing male is nothing but the juvenile form of tyranny, to be punished or at least to not be rewarded. Well, look, men do not group themselves together in groups on the basis of the expression of power. They only do that when the group has become pathological. It's not a good strategy. Men who are antisocial are not thriving. They tend to be friendless and alienated right from the beginning, right from the age of three. They never recover from that. It's not a good strategy. And the idea that power characterizes the patriarchy is a mythological and religious projection that bears virtually no resemblance to the actual facts. I've seen this happen in organizations all the time. Now and then they tilt towards authoritarianism, and then power-hungry people can rise up the ranks. But at that point, the whole organization is already corrupt and rotten, and the probability that it's going to fail extremely high. So look, here's just one fact that's relevant to that. Okay. The most aggressive people are two-year-olds, but most two-year-olds are not aggressive at all. 50% are aggressive sometimes, and 17% are chronically aggressive. All of them get less aggressive as they age and are socialized. A small fragment retain fairly high levels of violence, and they tend to be delinquents and criminals later in life. Okay, but what do you derive from that, apart from maybe modifying your theories about aggression? What you derive from that is that the expression of power is such a counterproductive strategy that it is reduced across the board as children develop. Well, that's revolutionary, that realization. It's like, really? Aggressive behavior decreases as children are socialized because it's not an effective strategy while you're moving ahead in life? No, it's reciprocal cooperation. I interviewed podcast personality and author, lecturer, and former soldier Jocko Willink 2 weeks ago, and he's masculine right to the bloody core. He's like 2 feet thick, and he's an intimidating person. And he wanted to be a warrior since he was two. He knew. And you can tell. All you have to do is look at him. All you have to do is listen to him for 15 seconds. And he became a Naval SEAL and was a commander of a section of the American Armed Forces. And he talked to me about his Naval SEAL training. It's like, well, what did they teach those hyper-masculine, aggressive guys? You have your buddy's back. That's the prime dictate. And these are organizations that are specialized for defensive aggression, let's say. So even under those circumstances, the chaotically violent male hasn't got a hope.
Interesting, because that took the steam off my last question. Could the reality change to the extent that aggression would be rewarded?
No, it can't. Well, there's even technical reasons it can't. So in any sophisticated organization, you're going to have to interact with the same person multiple times. And so only those individuals that are capable of reciprocity can thrive in any reasonable and stable and productive social environment. And that's so true that it's even true for chimpanzees. So, you know, you get this sense of the most powerful chimpanzee dominating and getting access to sexual resources, and it's all power. It's like, no, that isn't how it works. That happens now and then in chimp troops, but that power mad tyrant is very likely to be torn to pieces by rebellious subordinates in short order. And the chimps that maintain their grip on power, let's say, which isn't the right way to think about it, are characterized by a tremendous degree of long-term reciprocity. And it's no different. That's far magnified in human beings. So it's no wonder people tell me to crawl back under a rock, because I say, you think that it's a patriarchy and that it's based on power. It's like, you're wrong. That's wrong. And it's not only wrong, it's wrong in an unbelievably destructive way. You're going to destroy what you have that's valuable before you understand it. And you're going to punish people, especially young men, for manifesting their virtue because you reflexively associate it with a vice. And that's because you're ignorant and because you're malevolent. So it's no wonder she wants me to crawl under a rock.
Big jump to the last question. What do you think you will do 5 years from now, considering how many changes your life has taken the past 2-3 years?
Well, I guess I hope that I'll be doing something that's similar to what I'm doing now. If I'm lucky and my health maintains itself, I hope that I'll be serving as a public educator, using this unbelievable communications technology that we now have available. I want to talk to as many interesting people from all around the world that I can possibly entice into talking with me. I want to share that with as many people as I possibly can. That seems to be going well. I want to investigate the possibilities of this video and audio technology revolution that we're all taking part in. I want to write. I'm working on a new book now. I want to spend time with my wife and my family. I want to watch my grandkids grow up. And I want to do what I can to use my authority, let's say, to help people develop in as positive a way possible. And I want to learn to get better and better at that. So, and I want to build communities that'll encourage people to do that. And we've got plans for that already implemented. And I'm really excited about it. And we're releasing an app in a month or so, 2 months maybe, that should help people write better.
It sounds like you're full of hope and you're looking forward to the future.
I'm praying that I be blessed with the opportunity to continue doing what I'm doing and to get better at it. And I hope that happens, and it would be wonderful if it did. And I'm trying to do what I can to ensure that it will. Thank you, and thank you to everyone who's listening.
Upptäck det vackra ljudet av McCrispy & Company för endast 89 kronor. En riktigt krispig upplevelse. För ett ännu godare McDonald's.
Välkommen till Momang, ett nytt smidigare kasino från Svenska Spel, Sport och Casino, där du enkelt kan spela hur lite du vill. Idag har vi en stjärna från spelet Starburst här som ska berätta hur smidigt det är. Jaha, så smidigt alltså. Momang, för dig över 18 år. Stödlinjen.se.
Nej, dåliga vibrationer är att gå utan byxor till jobbet. Bra vibrationer är när du inser att mobilen är i bröstfickan. Få bra vibrationer med Vimla, mobiloperatören med Sveriges nöjdaste kunder enligt SKI.